It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up at 5:30, a look at Governor Walker's call for another two-year tuition freeze in the light of UW's budget surplus and what it means for the university, students, and families.
First, we continue our coverage of the Wisconsin Survey. The poll from WPR and St. Norbert College asked Wisconsinites what they thought about legalizing marijuana in Wisconsin.
The question comes up after two states have legalized marijuana use for recreational purposes and other states have legalized medical marijuana.
St. Norbert College political scientist Wendy Scattergood is with us to start things off. Wendy, welcome back.
Thank you.
Well, what did Wisconsin say about marijuana legalization?
Actually, the majority voted to keep it illegal. So 52% said that they felt it should be kept illegal. 42% said that they should pass a law similar to the Colorado law, and 6% were not sure.
Do we have a sense of who was who along partisan or other lines?
Yeah, there's a partisan difference significantly. So 54% of Democrats said we should pass a law similar to the Colorado law, compared to only 28% of Republicans, and then 49% of independents said we should pass a law like Colorado's.
You're on the Joy Cardine Show this morning talking about how some of the different issues polarize people. Was this one of the more or less polarizing issues along partisan lines?
It's actually about in the middle. So I think the most polarizing one was the minimum wage up to 10-10. And then the least was actually the civil unions' rights for same-sex couples. This was right about in the middle of the eight policy questions that we asked.
Have you included this issue in the survey before?
No, this is the first time we've asked about it.
Okay, why now? Because of, I assume, what's going on in the rest of the country?
Yeah, and there was some talk of maybe at least one person state legislature introducing a bill on it.
And do we have any other comparables? Have other surveys been tackling this issue yet, or is it just now becoming a big enough deal to where even pollsters are taking notice?
Yeah, there's actually a lot of national polls that are out on this right now, and just recently it has gone into the majority. So most of the polls are showing small majorities are actually in favor of legalizing marijuana. The Marquette poll actually found almost exactly what we found, and that is a majority still in Wisconsin think it should be kept illegal. So we're a little bit different than the national average at this point.
Interesting. Wendy, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Wendy Scattergood with St. Norbert College. Before we move on to our next guest, I'll invite you to weigh in on this issue at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin legalize marijuana for medical use, for recreational use, both or neither? That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go now to Mark Kleiman. He's been tracking marijuana laws and public opinion around the country. He's a professor of public policy at UCLA and a consultant to Washington State on marijuana policy. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, it seems like we've seen some rapid change in attitudes toward marijuana legalization in the last decade. How much have attitudes changed at the national level?
Oh, you've gone from roughly 25% pro-legalization to roughly 55%. So it's been a big move.
And I
think a somewhat unexpected move.
I was going to say that's
fast. Interesting. We've got two polls in Wisconsin that say otherwise. Maybe Wisconsin's different. I don't know what the age distribution is in Wisconsin. This tends to be a very heavily age-weighted issue with opposition from people over 65 and strong support from people under 30. So I don't know what the age distribution looks like. It might be the way the questions were asked, though. If you got two different polls that get the same answer, that's more persuasive.
I was going to ask, what's behind the change nationally? Is it mainly a generational shift?
No. That is to say, there are big generational differences, but there have been movements in the opinions in each birth cohort, each generation. So the boomers are now much more pro-pot legalization than they were 20 years ago when they had young kids. The millennials are for it even if they do have kids, which is sort of unprecedented. What's happened is decreasing confidence in the capacity of the prohibition system to work. And also, I think, the experience with medical marijuana, which in several states, including California and Colorado, amounted to virtual legalization. And I think the voters look around and say, well, this guy didn't fall, I guess. I'm a little puzzled by that. I would have thought the fact that the voters were sold pain relief for cancer patients and got pot legalization would have had them annoyed, but apparently not.
Well, not long ago, 5 years maybe, it would have been political career suicide for a politician to suggest legalization. Now we're seeing in some states politicians doing just that and keeping their jobs. Is that no longer the case? Is this no longer a taboo topic for politicians?
Well, it's still strange that we now have a national majority in favor of legalization and no single prominent national politician having taken that position. So I think there's still some cultural lag. It's partly that the law enforcement community is still pretty strongly against this, and no politician wants a bunch of blue uniforms against him. Mike Dukakis showed the problem with that. So I think politicians, to some extent, are scared off by that prospect. But I don't think that'll last. I think we're going to see some movement among national politicians. At current trend, it does look very much like gay marriage, right? I mean, 20 years ago, gay marriage was a fringe position. Now, being against it is a fringe position, and I think we could see the same thing happen with cannabis.
We've got a laboratory going on now in Colorado and Washington, though they haven't quite implemented this yet. What are we seeing in the early days of legalization in Colorado? Are people saying, wait, this isn't, I'm a little worried about how this is going, or it's just business as usual already?
It really hasn't fully kicked in. The state licensed a very limited number of growers, and a lot of people showed up the first day to buy. And so there were big price spikes. And at least the most recent reports I've seen, the commercial outlets in Colorado are selling at about twice the price as the medical outlets. So that suggests a very strong demand for the legal product, but I don't think we have any notion about what the consequences are going to be.
Do you think a lot of states and maybe voters in a lot of states are taking a wait-and-see position to see what happens in Colorado as that gets implemented and then in Washington?
Remember, the voters don't decide this, right? It's decided by people who write checks to circulate petitions. And the most important political thing that happened this year was that Peter Lewis, the founder of Progressive Insurance, who'd been writing those checks, unexpectedly passed away. And that's put a number of initiative processes on hold simply because nobody's got the money for them. So that's probably been postponed to 2016. I bet that didn't show up in your civics textbook. It didn't show up in mine.
It didn't. Well, and we don't have that.
That American politics is run by billionaires.
Well, we don't have that referendum procedure in a lot of states, including Wisconsin, so we can't pass a law with a well-funded public referendum. It would have to come ultimately through the state legislature. In states like that, is that going to be a longer wait?
That's going to be a longer wait. Now, my personal view is that it's better to have it done through the regular legislative process than by initiative. Tom Lehrer once said the problem with folk music is that it's written by the people who, by and large, have no talent. And I think that's true of legislation as well. I mean, when you do legislation by initiative, you know, what gets to be law is what polls well. There are no hearings, there's no cross-examination, there's no legislative analyst report, and it shows. On the other hand, if the politicians won't do it, then the voters, where they can, are going to move ahead. All of it's weird, given that it's still a felony under federal law. Right, so Colorado and Washington are now in the process of issuing state licenses to commit federal felonies. And again, I'd like to see Congress do its job, but there doesn't seem to be any strong movement in that direction.
We're talking to UCLA public policy professor Mark Kleiman about marijuana legalization after the new Wisconsin survey results suggest that a majority of Wisconsinites are not ready to see the drug legalized. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now with Mark Kleiman, professor of public policy at UCLA and a consultant to Washington State on marijuana policy. We're talking about marijuana legalization and what the public thinks about it.
And we want to know what you think. Call at 800-642-1234. Would you like to see marijuana legalized nationally in Wisconsin? Why or why not? Recreational or medicinal use? If legal, how would you like to see it regulated? Again, 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's go to our callers now. We've got Peg on the line in Rice Lake. Peg, hi.
Hello there. I'd like to see marijuana legalized because through the years I've seen a lot of people use it, and I've really never seen them acting like people sometimes do when they're drinking alcohol. I think it's safer. But I especially would like to see medical marijuana legalized because I have been crippled for 8 years after Lyme disease, and I don't want to get addicted to oxycodone. If I could space it off a little bit with marijuana, that would be great. Thank you.
Peg, thanks a lot for your call. First, she makes the argument, Mark, compare it to alcohol, the harm not as bad, so why isn't marijuana also legal, she says?
A serious argument. If you thought we had a good policy toward alcohol and you thought cannabis was less dangerous, then it would follow that we should have a less restrictive policy toward cannabis. If you think, as I do, that we have a silly policy toward alcohol that's way too loose and allows way too many people to damage themselves and other people, then the fact that marijuana is safer isn't necessarily a reason to treat it as loosely as we do alcohol, which is the direction we're moving in places like Washington and Colorado. Now, if it turned out that people used pot instead of drinking, that would be a very strong argument. We just don't know whether it's true or not. That's one of the big unknowns about cannabis legalization. I think the question you asked was the right question, which is, if we legalize it, how? And my answer would be not the way we legalized alcohol.
How would you like to see marijuana legalized? As states make this decision, what is a good way to implement this?
Well, the two key factors are price and information. You'd like the prices not to fall much below the current illicit price, and you'd like the flow of information to be reasonably balanced between promotional messages and health messages. Neither of those are you going to get from a commercial system. I'd like to see a state monopoly on retailing or a rule that only not-for-profits or cooperatives can sell. What you don't want is for somebody to be in the business of selling cannabis, because the only way you can make money in that business is to sell it to people who use too much. Moderate smokers simply don't smoke enough to be good customers. Same thing's true with alcohol. And it seems to me those are businesses where the commercial interest and the public interest simply do not coincide.
So you'd like to see a change in the way we sell alcohol, too, to make it more like what you're talking about for marijuana?
It'd be very hard to do with alcohol because of the political power of the beer distributors. And so I would not like to see a comparably powerful cannabis industry emerge. With alcohol, the easiest thing we could do is simply raise the tax. You raise the tax on a drink by 20 cents. We'd reduce homicide and auto fatalities by 6% each. And that would put almost no burden on anybody who's a responsible drinker. And yet that simple idea has no political muscle behind it. All the states have been through fiscal crises, and we've done all sorts of things about that. And nobody's done the obvious thing of raising the tax on beer.
Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Katie in Madison. Katie, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And I just wanted to make a comment about the form of marijuana. I saw a documentary a while back on the marijuana legalization in Colorado and a manufacturer who was making marijuana in bath salts. And I have a pain autoimmune problem that really causes a lot of pain, and occasionally I have to rely on opioids to control the pain, and I'd rather not do that. And I've seen good reports on people who rely on marijuana for pain control, and so I'd like to have the opportunity to try that to see if that's effective or not. And I think in that regard I would support it. Our imagination takes us to, you know, the people who roll marijuana in papers and they smoke it in secret. And, you know, that's not the vision that I see that marijuana is leading us to. And that's, I'd like to hear more discussion about that.
Katie, thanks for the call. And yeah, she's bringing up more of the medical marijuana argument, which used to be, seemed like the main part of the debate nationwide. Are people still making the case specifically for medical marijuana, Mark? Or is are they just going for recreational?
Florida is likely to do that by initiative this year. That'll be the big legal change this year. The sad thing is that due to both the economics of the pharmaceutical industry and obstruction by federal agencies, we simply have not done the appropriate research. Marijuana or cannabis properly is the name of a plant, not the name of a medicine, right? A medicine is a material of known composition that a physician can give to a patient with instructions and have a reasonable idea about what the consequences are going to be. Two cannabis plants can have completely different chemical composition. Different parts of the same plant can have completely different chemical composition. If I have an infection, my physician does not say to me, you should probably take some antibiotic for that and send me to the antibiotic dispensary where I talk to the guy in the baseball cap behind the counter. He says, oh, yeah, the purple kush is really good for that infection. Right? The physician writes me a prescription that says 100 milligrams of amoxicillin 3 times a day with meals for 7 days. The problem is that we're not at the stage in cannabis therapeutics where anybody can write that prescription. We don't have those medicines on the market, and we don't have the medical research about what they're good for. And so it's medical only, sort of in quotation marks. It's more like a nutraceutical. And I wish that both sides of the debate over non-medical use would get out of the way of the medical research.
And so you're saying you'd like to see more research and maybe fewer restrictions on that research from the anti side, but maybe less grandiose claims from the pro side?
Well, I don't see any reason why some of the people writing checks to fund initiatives couldn't write some checks to fund medical research.
Right, back...
And for the cost of doing one middle-sized state, you could actually have the answer.
Go back to our
cannabis
call.
Could actually, you could have some form of cannabis actually an approved FDA medicine. Around $5 million.
All right, we'll go back to our callers now. We've got Tom on the line in La Crosse. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm curious, how would the legalization of marijuana in the United States affect the violence involved with the whole international drug trade? Would it be would it be helpful or not?
Tom, thanks for bringing that up. Another angle of attack on the drug war and marijuana. And Mark, where would that fall, do you think?
I don't think there's any doubt that it would help Mexico some. The Mexican drug trafficking organizations probably get 20%, maybe as much as 30% of their drug export revenues selling cannabis to the U.S. And if we took that market away from them, there would probably be less violence. But most of the violence in Mexico has to do with cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine. And so the notion that we can get rid of all the pains of the drug war just by legalizing pot, not going to happen.
Another argument along similar lines is that we're putting a lot of law enforcement money into enforcing marijuana laws, and then there's incarceration costs related to that. Is that an important part of the debate?
Same answer. We're arresting a lot of people for cannabis possession, and we could get rid of that simply by repealing the possession laws. The prosecution side, they're about 500,000 people behind bars at any one time in the U.S. for drug law violations, which is a shockingly high number. But of that 500,000, somewhere between 30 and 40,000 are there for cannabis, 6 to 8% of drug war prisoners are in there for cannabis offenses. So no, we can't greatly reduce law enforcement expenditure and incarceration by legalizing cannabis.
Can you take a minute just to...
But we can do some, right? I mean, those 30,000 people don't need to be behind bars.
Can you take just a minute to look ahead? What's the next frontier in the marijuana legalization debate, a state to watch or an issue to watch?
Again, Florida medical this year. The polling I've seen suggests it's likely to pass. I don't know how tightly that's written. I mean, some of the medical marijuana states, it's actually pretty restricted to people with genuine medical need. Some of them, like California and Colorado and Western Washington, it's wide open, and I don't know which side of that divide Florida falls on. The big thing to watch is California 2016. I think we're likely to get a full commercial legalization passing that year. I doubt it'll be I doubt it will be the kind I like, but I think that's likely to happen. And once California, which is an eighth of the country, has gone, I think it's going to be very hard to restrict the national movement.
Thanks to Mark Kleiman for joining us today. He's professor of public policy at UCLA and a consultant to Washington State on marijuana policy.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, asparagus is one of the first spring veggies we're getting excited about. We'll get some asparagus advice from farm-to-table chef Ian Knauer.
But first, the University of Wisconsin system will likely end the current fiscal year with over $1 billion in surplus. Governor Walker today proposed a two-year tuition freeze to make education more affordable, he said.
That comes on the heels of a similar two-year tuition freeze, which was part of the budget bill Governor Walker signed into law last year.
We've asked Noel Radomski, director of the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Post-Secondary Education, to give some insight on the budget surplus and how an additional two-year tuition freeze could affect the UW system and its students. Noel, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
So why did Governor Walker call for a second two-year tuition freeze for the UW system today?
Well, similar to just prior to the last year or the last biennial budget, UW system came out this morning at their Board of Regents meeting stating that they had a slightly over $1 billion in reserves. And there was confusion on what that actually means. For example, is it are any of those is the $1 billion plus restricted or unrestricted, meaning are they do they have a plan to spend the money or do they not have a plan to spend the money? And there's lots of confusion. There was confusion 3 years ago, and again, there's confusion this morning. So what that then triggered was Governor Walker then to say, we're going to propose a tuition freeze, a tuition cap, during the next biennial budget. And then we had the Assembly Majority Leader Robin Voss came out with a press release stating the same thing. So now it's percolating throughout the legislature and the governor's office saying, here we go again, second time. We're tired of tuition increases. We're tired of the UW system not being fully transparent with this. And therefore, we are where we are today.
So as you said, there's already one of these two-year tuition freezes in place. Mm-hmm. If this passes, that'll be a total of 4 years. How significant is that?
It's very significant, both short-term and long-term. The short-term is we are using our reserves for something that in the past, recent past, was picked up partially by the state. So what that means then is for to offer salary increases for our faculty or to retain certain faculty or recruit faculty, there'll be limited revenues to do that. There's uncertainty in whether or not the governor and the legislature will increase state taxes to the UW system, or will they do what they did last time, is they will reduce the state contribution and substitute that with the reserves. So from a short-term perspective, it could have some immediate impact on both the hiring and the retention of our faculty. Long-term, there's a couple things going on. One, this is percolating throughout the country. And as other public and private universities begin to focus on new areas of focus for their universities, they raid faculty, especially at those universities that they see are vulnerable. So if there are, you know, such as the UW system, so UW-Milwaukee, UW-Madison, UW-Stevens Point, the salaries for faculty and staff have been relatively low increases. So you'll see, I would predict we'll see more faculty, unfortunately, that will be raided from our campuses, which will have a direct impact on our teaching and also in our research grants that we get. If we lose some of our star faculty, they take their federal research dollars with them.
That's been a critique that's been made before of the UW system that it has had, even before the budget freeze, or the tuition freeze, rather, has had the effect of not retaining faculty at the UW system, maybe not having difficulty in doing that. But besides the faculty issue, what about upkeep and existing programs and facilities, things like that?
Yeah. Well, as it relates to facilities, that will be a separate revenue sources through the State Building Commission. So that won't be impacted through this decision. Other operating support, such as academic advising, which is critical, especially at larger universities like Milwaukee and Madison, that will be impacted. Libraries, expenses such as information technology, those all could be affected by this decision if it's approved by the legislature in the next biennial budget.
Now, Governor Walker said he was calling for this two-year tuition freeze to help students and families to get access to higher education, in particular working families. Just how helpful will this tuition freeze be for those students that he's targeting?
I think that's true in the sense of if the tuition is frozen, obviously, the cost of the parent and the students won't increase, such as what's going on in the state of Minnesota or other states nearby. So from that perspective, he's absolutely correct. The unknown question is, as stated, as we just discussed, what impact will that have on the quality of the instruction? So, yes, it will help the students and the families, but at what cost? And if it were just for a two-year period, most universities can handle it, but we're now talking about 4 years of this, so it raises some important questions. Again, I'm not downplaying the issues that came through having yet again reserves in the area of $1 billion that aren't fully explained to legislators and to the governor. So I don't want to downplay that.
Now, having a big rainy day fund, a surplus, is considered a prudent thing oftentimes for large institutions. Why has the UW system surplus been so contentious?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Just like a family or a business, you always want to have some money on the side if your car breaks down or if you need to put a new roof in, or if you're a business, you want to expand your product line, so you need to buy some new equipment. And colleges, universities are the same way. The whole question is, how big is it? And how do you explain what is truly reserves that are projected, as opposed to those that are not projected? And I think that's where that's the big issue. And I think that there's some really interesting questions related to how the UW system basically. States their revenue sources, whether or not they're investing. If you have a large surplus and if you're not going to be spending it for 1 or 2 or 3 years, that's a significant amount of money that could be invested, and therefore that rate of return could be used to hire more faculty. So there's a lot of unintended consequences if you have too large of a reserve, so that the university is not investing the unused money, the surplus.
A lot of talk these days about the heavy load that students are carrying in debt after they graduate from college, how it could be stopping them from saving for retirement, for instance, maybe getting married, putting a mortgage down, getting a mortgage on a house. Is this the sort of thing that you see families in Wisconsin cheering because it's some relief?
Yeah, absolutely. And you saw it at the biennial budget. You had Democrats and Republicans from both the Senate and the Assembly basically saying this is a good thing, having a tuition freeze. So you're right. It's, and I obviously Governor Walker and some others are going through re-election in November. So it certainly sells well with the public. So you're absolutely right. With the large tuition increases over the last decade, partly due to reductions in state funding, students had to take out larger loans, and therefore, when they graduate, instead of buying a car, they may buy a used car, or instead of buying a house, they may wait 2 or 3 or 4 years to buy a house. So yes, you're right. This is whether or not it would actually decrease the level of student debt is uncertain, but you're right. It won't increase, and therefore it may help families and students.
Transparency was an issue the last time a billion-dollar surplus was announced, and that was something that legislators took issue with. And we've got another big surplus again. How is the transparency issue looking today?
Just as bad as 2 or 3 years ago. Yesterday they provided some information on how their endowment is doing, the UW system endowment, which is another topic. Basically, UW system, unlike other states, other systems in other states, they don't combine their financial reports, so we can all see, you know, here's an endowment from UW system, right? They have quite a bit of money in there, and then they invest that, just like we have GPR and tuition in reserves. So I guess the issue here in UW system is, are we behind the times and having a more robust and more comprehensive and more transparent financial system? And then it has a direct impact on campuses. You know, some folks have said perhaps there should be greater authority and greater accountability at the individual campus level. So why is it that the reserves are staying at UW system, whereas the chancellors of every campus like Milwaukee and Whitewater, La Crosse, they know how much reserves they are collecting. So why doesn't that money stay there? And then they have, they're close, they know which faculty need to be retained and which faculty need to be hired and which programs need to be created to better serve the businesses in their regions. So I think there's a really fundamental question that we didn't ask and we didn't answer in the last time around. And I think that we'll see some, if people are going to be candid about this, they'll ask the question, what is the role of the UW system? What is the role of the UW institutions? And should there be transfer of power more to the individual campuses so that they're held accountable?
No, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We've been talking to Noel Radomski, director of the Wisconsin Center for the Advancement of Postsecondary Education.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, it's time to get digging in the dirt again, to head back to the farmers markets and just enjoy the color green. Well, our next guest is with us to celebrate the return of one of spring's first vegetables, asparagus.
On Food Friday, Ian Knauer joins us once a month. He's back today. He's the host of a PBS series called The Farm and author of the cookbook by the same name. Ian grows his own food on his family land in Pennsylvania. Ian, welcome back.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we mentioned, Ian, one of the first veggies that I get excited about anyway is the asparagus. Do you grow that on your farm, and is it popping up yet?
We do, and it's just starting to pop its tips out of the soil. Actually, asparagus is one of those vegetables that will come back year after year after year. So some of the asparagus that is growing on my family's farm was planted there by my grandfather some 30 years ago, and
okay.
It's still barely holding on and gives us some asparagus from him every year.
Oh, do you still eat it? Does it still taste as good as the newer stuff you plant?
It tastes just like asparagus.
And that's a good thing. Well, how exciting is it as a farmer to see the spring growing season begin again?
Oh, especially after this winter.
I mean,
I feel like it was such a doozy everywhere in this country. We were just waiting and waiting and waiting for anything green to pop up. And the last couple days, at least here on the East Coast, I can't speak for you guys, have been just exquisitely beautiful. It's such a welcome change.
Oh, here too. Well, with the asparagus, I'll eat it year-round. I'll eat the stuff trucked in from the southern hemisphere because I really like my asparagus. But it does get better. How can we judge asparagus? What makes it the perfect ripeness, if we describe ripeness for asparagus?
The real key to finding the freshest asparagus is how snappy it is, how easily and crisp it is when you break it in half, or when you take a bite out of it, too. You can really taste the difference texturally between stuff that is grown in season and stuff that is grown somewhere else in the world and then shipped in. So that's the best way to do it. Take a bite out of it, and it's super crispy and crunchy and watery, then you'll know that it's local and it's fresh.
Sometimes I have a very slight issue with asparagus in that I hate it when I get the part of the stalk that just is like chewing cardboard. And I never know, like when I'm cooking it, because my family loves asparagus, how to make sure you don't end up serving people that part. And generally, I chop it so close to the tip that that's all I'm serving. I have a feeling I'm wasting a lot. Is there a rule for how to be, you know, sure that you're getting the good stuff?
Yeah, There are a couple tricks. One is that asparagus are like snowflakes. Each one is a little different. So if you cut them all the same length, some will be trimmed the proper length, and others will be still a little too long, and you'll have some of that woody bottom on the end of the stalk. So instead of just cutting them all off and lopping them off with a knife, you want to take it in your fingertips, each hand on each side of the stalk of asparagus, and then add some pressure, pointing it away from you so that it snaps, and it'll know where to snap. The asparagus will know where it needs to snap so that you're left with only the tender parts instead of the woody parts.
Okay, so now, trust the wisdom of the asparagus.
Exactly, yeah. The asparagus is smarter than you are. So
Wait, what?
The other trick is to do what the French do. They peel the bottom of the stalk with a vegetable peeler. Now, that's sort of a pain, but I do have to say that if you want a perfectly evenly crisp or tender stalk of asparagus, it is the way to go. It's also quite pretty when you peel the bottoms.
So we've found our perfectly fresh asparagus. We've snapped it or peeled it appropriately. What do you like to do to prepare it, Ian?
Well, asparagus is one of those vegetables where I think most of us just have it steamed all the time because it's easy, and it's also great that way. But I actually love it any way that I can imagine. So I love to puree it. I love to slice it sort of paper thin and eat it raw. That makes a really great salad. You can also use a vegetable peeler to make long shavings with it, long ribbons with it, raw ribbons. Or I like it pureed into soups. I love it roasted. So pretty much any way that I can think of to eat it is how I'm going to eat it.
Can you give us a simple recipe? If you're going to do an asparagus soup, how would you approach that?
Mm-hmm. So I would start out by cooking some aromatics, maybe some clove of garlic or some leeks would be great, or a shallot, in just a little bit of butter or olive oil if you prefer that. Not until it's brown, but until it's translucent. Then you want to add some sort of light chicken stock, or you could even use vegetable stock or water if you want to, and add your asparagus to that stock and boil it until it's very tender. Now, for a soup, you can go beyond cooking like you would if you were just going to steam it, for instance, where you might want it crisp tender. So you want to go until it's still bright green but is pretty mushy, and then you just blend it all up. You can finish it with a little cream or a little crème fraîche if you want a richer soup, or you can just keep it simple and let that asparagus shine through.
Mm. Are there any spices that go particularly well? I usually just do kosher salt and pepper when I do it in my cast iron skillet. Anything else that goes really well with asparagus in the herbs and spices family?
I do really like nutmeg with it. That's sort of a classic pairing, and not too much. You don't want to go too heavy on the nutmeg, but just a pinch at the end, like if you're making that soup, for instance, gives it sort of a sophisticated air to it.
What about cinnamon?
No.
Cinnamon is, you know, I've never tried cinnamon with asparagus, but it might not be a bad idea if you pair it with some other warm spices like cumin or coriander. Throw all those in there, just a little bit, a pinch of each, and you might end up with something that's sort of Moroccan-inspired.
Oh, that sounds pretty good. I'm just trying to make Rob feel bad. He's allergic to
cinnamon. Yeah. She just doesn't want to share. Can you
Let's
believe
just
it?
Put it in everything.
I do like it, yeah. So what else are you cooking with besides asparagus? Is there anything that's up enough that you can actually be eating it yet?
Yes. Around here, we are eating ramps starting today. Today is the first day that I've found some ramps that are big enough to pick and eat. And that's always a treat in the spring. I love ramps. They're sort of like funky, wild leeks. They've got a lot more flavor than garlic or leeks, and they're sort of a combination of the two. So I love them. All the chefs I know around here love them, and we all eagerly await the first time that we cook ramps.
You can't cultivate ramps, right? Is it something you have to forage for?
Ah, so this is a great myth. I'm so glad that you brought that up, because this is what foragers say, that no, you can't cultivate ramps, and therefore the prices at the market are incredibly high. In the green market in New York, there's something like $20 a pound, which is shocking for garlic. But you can actually cultivate them if you have the right environment. So when you buy ramps, there's a little nub on the bottom where the roots are. That's a nodule that actually acts as a rhizome. So if you cut that off and plant that, it has a pretty good chance of sprouting some more ramps a couple years down the road.
Hmm.
Now, the atmosphere that you want is near a creek or some gently running water, but not in it. So watercress likes to be in the running water. Ramps like to be just on the edge. They like a good dose of water every month or so if we get a heavy rain, but they don't like to live in it all the time.
So we can break the monopoly of Big Ramp and grow our own.
That's right. Stick it to the man.
Well, Ian, thanks so much for coming on. It was always fun to talk with you.
Oh, I had a great time. Happy spring.
Happy spring to you, too. Well, that was Ian Knauer, host of the PBS series The Farm and the author of the cookbook by the same name. I'm pretty sure he told me that asparagus is smarter than I am.
Yeah, I got that impression. I kind of believe it. I'm going to try that snapping thing because I usually just go with the knife and lop it all at the same spot. And then you're right, Veronica, you get that chewy bit
right
at the end of like a third of them
the
or
dregs.
So. Yeah, and the kids like spit it out. And yeah. So yeah, a great tip. Thanks to Ian Knauer for that. Hey, coming up Monday here on Central Time, new guidelines say we are still not eating enough fruits and vegetables, a reason to get that asparagus going. We'll find out why it may be time to up our servings.
And a new Conservation Congress vote is coming up. We'll tell you what's on the table, including a proposal to hunt swans.
And CBS News travel writer Peter Greenberg shares his love of roaming and exploring. It'll be a lot of fun. He's a good interview. He has a lot of fun on the radio. He'll have some advice for our summer travel as well.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.